Patterns, Practices, and Impediments of Mimetic Mentorship was a talk given by Diane Gray at the 2025 Gutenberg Education Conference, titled Teacher as Mentor. Diane Gray is a wife, musician, scientist, contractor, tutor, and mother of seven. After 12 years in biotech research and development, she switched careers to guide her children's home education. In addition to homeschooling, she serves as an area representative with Classical Conversations, supporting the greater Portland area and Oregon, and also serves on the Gutenberg College Board of Governors. We hope you enjoy this presentation.
Thank you very much, David. Thank you, Gutenberg staff, Chris and Elliot, for the invitation to contribute to this exploration of the topic, Teacher as Mentor. I'm thankful for all of the contributors here this weekend, speakers, and each of you. You're here contributing something beautiful to adorn the body of Christ, the temple of the Holy Spirit. But you're not just here to contribute, but you're also here to receive. So I hope that there is something that you're able to receive from each person you interact with and hear. Have you heard the phrase, more is caught than taught? That phrase has been on my mind as I have been preparing for this day, thinking over it, about it over the course of the summer. And what first comes to mind is the Shema from Deuteronomy 6. Shema Israel, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might, or all of your muchness. These words which I command you today shall be upon your heart, and you shall teach them diligently to your children. When you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise up, they shall be a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets before your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your heart, of your house, and your heart, and on your gates. We hear this admonishment, teach your children diligently. We hear the admonishment in the New Testament, older ones teach the younger ones. And we see in Proverbs the admonishment to listen to and walk with the wise. So this is my crew, current crew. We have four high school graduates, one married. This was taken in February, just this last year. So no grandchildren yet. And this year I like to say I'm only homeschooling three. We've been homeschooling with Classical Conversations for about 16 years, and I've held a number of leadership positions within the organization. And from those experiences, I've gained much practice and wisdom, made lots and lots of mistakes. In fact, some of my family members are here, and I've begged them to not stand up in the middle of my talk and say, liar! So with that, I had to also admit some of the impediments within my own mentorship. So I'm fairly confident that they have caught a whole lot more from me than what I've taught them in their academic lessons. There are good things about that, and there are really challenging and sad things about that. But my desire here today is to challenge each of you to contemplate some of the patterns, the practices, and impediments of mimetic mentorship, to conduct some self-evaluation and intentionally choose a step of growth. Perhaps it's a place of repentance and a step of growth. But that's my challenge for us today. So to that end, I'm going to begin with a story. Then I'm going to walk through some definitions. We're going to confront the impediments first. Let's just get the hard stuff out of the way. And then discuss patterns and practices that you may consider incorporating into your own mentoring relationships. This is a picture of the Antarctic. I've been at the Arctic, but I have not been to the Antarctic. That is on my bucket list. This story was written by Michael Obel. He's a Presbyterian pastor and teacher, and he wrote and published this in 2002. I've edited it for brevity. Every now and then, God's care and guidance can be stunning. Believers ought to take such opportunities to marvel afresh at our Creator's care and guidance. Such an opportunity can be found in the life of Sir Ernest Shackleton. Few men have had as dramatic an experience of providence as he and the 27 men he took to the bottom of the world for the Imperial Trans-Antarctic Expedition of 1914 to 1916. Here's the story of that expedition. Long before 1914, Shackleton was a seasoned Antarctic explorer. In 1901, Captain Robert Scott, the British explorer, engaged him as a lieutenant on a failed expedition to the South Pole. Shackleton had to leave that trip because of scurvy, but 5 years later, he was back, this time leading his own expedition to the pole, of which he made it within 97 miles. After the Norwegian adventurer Roald Amundsen succeeded in reaching the pole in December of 1911, only one distinction remained: to lead the first trek across the continent. This became Shackleton's goal. After months of fundraising, he went to Norway's best shipyard and bought a new 300-ton wooden barkentine, the Endurance, as fine a vessel as had ever plied ice-infested waters. Likewise, the men he selected were the best available seamen and officers. On August 1st, 1914, they sailed from London. After final provisioning in Argentina, they arrived at South Georgia Island on November 5th. For 4 weeks, they waited for Antarctica's summer to set in. Then, on December 5th, they set a course for the Weddell Sea. 2 days later, they encountered heavy but loose pack ice. Using the vessel's engine and sails, they drove into it. Eventually, the crew began to walk ahead of the ship and manly broke up the ice. But progress was slow. Then, on January 18, 1915, when they were close to Antarctica's coast, the pack ice encased the Endurance. She could only move slightly, listing to one side, lifting a bit at one or the other. For the next 10 months, the ice carried the vessel and her crew hundreds of miles north in the general direction of South America. Without radio contact, they were cut off from the rest of humanity. The emotional wear and tear on the men was a constant challenge to Shackleton. He confronted the beginning of a mutiny, reconciled brawlers, and built unity by exchanging his perks as the top officer for the common chores of the lowest seaman. On October 26th, the Endurance was no longer able to withstand the forces of the ice floes and monstrous pressure ridges. The slow implosion of her hull, audible for months, was now agonizingly visible. The Endurance would never take them home. Shackleton gave the order to abandon ship, and the men removed as much of the ship's supplies as they could carry. On November 21st, her twisted and splintered remains slipped to the bottom of the Weddell Sea. The men, taking up the dog team's harnesses, began dragging their three lifeboats north, hoping to reach the Atlantic Ocean. Only the barest essentials could be taken. Cameras, film, books, even the ship's Bible were all left behind. Shackleton, however, did tear out and keep a page from the book of Job. It said, "Out of whose womb came the ice, and the hoary frost of heaven, who hath gendered it? The waters are hid as with a stone, and the face of the deep is frozen." Eventually, the ice began to thin, but became treacherous, especially when the men camped. One night, Shackleton had to pull a man, still in his sleeping bag, out of the frigid sea because the ice had broken. On April 9th, 1916, Shackleton gave the order to launch the three lifeboats amidst the ice floes, the icebergs, and the killer whales. The plan was to sail north. It was minus 10 degrees Fahrenheit, and the South Atlantic Ocean was raging. During that week, the men endured the most abysmal conditions. One sailor collapsed, another one developed frostbite that led to gangrene. And in a few days, they landed on Elephant Island, a barren outcropping that offered nothing in the way of food or water or shelter. Some men wept, others struggled to stay sane. Something had to give. Shackleton announced that he and five chosen men would sail the largest of the lifeboats, 22 feet long, 800 miles through the South Atlantic to South Georgia Island. It is difficult to describe the improbability of such a venture succeeding, but succeed they did. Through 60-foot waves and gale-force winds that were so frigid that New Zealand's navigator Frank Worsley could only manage five sightings with a borrowed sextant, these six men not only stayed afloat, but actually reached South Georgia Island 16 horrific days later. Suffering acute dehydration, extreme exhaustion, and frostbite, the men found fresh water, wild game, and shelter. But they also found a mountain range between them and where they needed to be, the whaling station, which was on the other side of the island. It was not possible to sail around the island to the station, so a few of them would have to cross the island on foot. Early on May 19th, with the light of the full moon, Shackleton, Worsley, and a rugged Irish sailor named Tom Crean began climbing the mountains and crossing the glacial crevices. Without the benefit of one real meal, a tent, or even an hour of sleep, these three pressed on for 36 hours until they walked into the same Norwegian whaling station from which they had set off nearly 2 years earlier. It was now May 20th, 1916. Once the Norwegians picked up the three men on the other side of the island, the push was on to return to Elephant Island and rescue the majority of the crew. They were living under the two overturned lifeboats and subsisting on a broth of water and penguin carcasses. Death was very near. Three times, Shackleton tried to reach his men, but pack ice stopped him. Finally, using a borrowed Chilean vessel, Shackleton found an opening in the ice and rescued his men. It was August 30th, 1916, more than 2 years since the Endurance had sailed from London. This was the achievement of Sir Ernest Shackleton. Every one of his men survived. One suspects that the greatest voyager of ancient Greece, Odysseus himself, would have stood in the presence of this man, Sir Ernest Shackleton, the last great explorer of the Victorian age. How does the story of Shackleton relate to the mission of mimetic mentorship? Well, one, both are stories of tremendous voyage. Both face unsurmountable barriers. In both, they require adaptable and considerate leadership. Both demand unwavering perseverance. And both experience miraculous survival. So we're going to go over some definitions first. These are a conglomeration from online dictionaries and my own imagination. But first, patterns. These are all words taken from the title. A repeated design, form, or model used for description, guidance, or imitation. So we'll be looking at some of these forms and models. Practice, the actual application or use of an idea, belief, or method through a repeated or customary action. An impediment, something that makes progress, movement, or achieving something difficult or impossible. Mimetic, relating to or characterized by or exhibiting mimicry, which is imitation. And finally, mentorship, The activity of giving a younger or less experienced person help and advice over a period of time, especially at work or school. Or it's the influence, guidance, or direction given by a trusted teacher, counselor, or guide. Thank you, Chris, for the great foundation about mentorship. All right, well, let's tackle this harder part first. Impediments. Or technically, the main problem. So many people fear gaps. As a homeschooling mom, and as one who mentors homeschooling mothers and fathers, one of the most common questions is, but what if I forget? What if I don't teach it right? What if I leave something out? Well, news break, we're all going to leave something out. But those breaks are important. A break is a space between two loci. It's unfilled space. It's an unknown area, a crack or a chasm. And those are necessary. And we tend to look at this struggle or these gaps or the struggle that people go through to accept gaps. We approach it with a fearful perspective. What people need to learn is how to handle the struggle, the wrestling, the challenges, and the suffering. Why do we have and fear gaps? I would propose that it's because we're striving with the seven C's. And maybe there's more, but here are seven that I very quickly identified. Capacity, capability, care, curiosity, credentials, competency, and certainty. These are all things we wrestle with when it comes to being in a position where we are impacting others. They are catching what we are offering, or maybe not verbally, but in our actions and in how we trust, how we navigate. Oftentimes, we value or have misplaced values and goals and loves. We aren't focusing on the right things. And rather than pursuing God and His virtue, His wisdom, His truth, and teaching our students that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, we try to fill knowledge banks and experience tanks in order to feel successful. We're putting our value and our attention and our efforts in the wrong place. We need to pursue His truth, His goodness, His beauty. And when we put ourselves under the governance of the world system, striving with those seven C's, we're going to find ourselves missing the mark. Another observation is that we often succumb to what I'm going to call the venomous vortex. It's that place of pride and fear and guilt and shame and doubt and so on and so on and so on. The things that are lies or they are things that have happened, but we're not able to move past them, they keep us in this vortex. They keep us away from what we are to be doing as mentors, as leaders, as parents. So our impediments, let's just admit, they get in our way. And we'll talk a little bit more about what we can do to overcome those. But first, let's look at some patterns or truths to recognize what we need to combat these impediments. We need gaps. This is our place of need. Shackleton needed gaps in the ice for his ship to move forward. And when they weren't present, his men had to make the gaps. It's the same with our learning. That is the space that we need for learning. If we don't have them, then there is no need. There's no need to bring in the next piece of information. But more importantly, we as humans need to learn how to encounter and endure them. But this is the space where virtue develops. So one pattern, we as humans need these gaps. Also, we as human beings love to resolve discord. We love to resolve those gaps. We want to fill them in. And that's a good thing. We love to find harmony. But what happens when we stop feeling that need to fill the gaps? When we stop feeling that need to resolve discord? Another pattern is we are not born mature, and we are either growing or we're decaying. Are we moving towards growth, or are we moving away from that? We often want stability and change. As a leader in an organization that helps lots and lots of people, I can say that one of the most challenging things that we encounter is when changes come. But the change is there because they wanted something. They want stability, but they want it their way. There's this dichotomy of we want it to be safe and comfortable, but then we get bored where we're at. It's not right. It doesn't suit me. So on and so forth. So how do we navigate this dichotomy? Also, another pattern, we naturally learn mimetically, which means we naturally learn from watching people, observing, seeing what they do, seeing what they don't do, and internally processing, I want to do that, or I am not going to do that. And finally, another pattern, we humans seek shortcuts and substitutions, as opposed to the good things that God has for us. This happened with the first man and woman in the garden. They saw a shortcut to what God had for them, and they took it. We get caught up in our guilt and our shame and our fear and our pride, and we look to things to comfort ourselves and to cope. We seek shortcuts and substitutions, which in its own way is idolatry. We're not seeking the proper source. So each of these patterns, we could talk for hours about each of them, but my purpose here was just to give a quick overview of some things that I've identified. I'm sure there are more, but these are just some ones that came to me that I wanted to share. So then best practices, what can one teach? One can teach skills, ideas, information, appreciation. Well, ideally, we want to personally pursue God, his kingdom, a virtue, and righteousness. We want to pursue him. We want to pursue rightness in ourselves, what we are intended to be, the humans we were intended to be, through his strength, through his spirit, and live rightly with others. And in that, this steers us away from that venomous vortex, because humility will conquer pride. Love overcomes fear. Forgiveness dissolves guilt. Dignity replaces shame, for you are an image bearer of the Most High God. And faith overwhelms doubt. When we have personalized that, when we are working on our stuff and doing the work, we then can prioritize the formation of heart, character, and skill for others over the content. So it's not about the math, the history, the language arts, the poetry. We need to recognize the nature of the human and what is needed for proper formation. Thirdly, we need to understand and inculcate the elements of the mimetic learning process. Now, this is thanks to the CIRSE Mimetic Intensive with Andrew Kern. I signed up for that 2 years ago. I didn't attend it. I listened to it over the last couple of weeks. And that's just where it fit in. And there were wonderful things that I gleaned from that. And I've been able to incorporate that with many of the tools that we learn and practice in classical conversations. What I would call the 15 skills. Those can be found in the catalog. Alicia has catalogs out on the table, page 7. Because we won't really go into those skills because I wanted to highlight a little bit more about this process. Andrew describes this process as he slows it way down. When we teach well, we are naturally doing these. When we are learning, we are naturally walking through these steps. So this is a real slow down to what's actually happening. So there's gathering, there's wondering, attending, contemplating, illuminating, embodying, and ruling. So the gathering, what is the gathering? That is preparing the mind. So the mentor, the teacher is asking, what do you know? They're assessing, what does my audience know? What do you already know about numbers or math or these animals or this environment? So that they can then know, what's the next thing? What's the easy plus one? What wonder can I create? What gap can I illuminate to say, look, there's something unknown here. Do you want to go discover it? So that is the wondering. We are creating a curiosity or that need, tapping into that human need for gaps and to resolve discord or dissolve and what's needed to be known. Then attending, presenting types or examples. And this is where I like to tie in the 15 skills that we work on in classical conversations. What we call the 5 core habits, which is, and there's an acronym, NAMES. It's about naming, attending, memorizing, expressing, and storytelling. Getting to the very grammatical pieces of what's in front of me. Then there's contemplating, analyzing types and examples. And that's where I would pull in the 5 common topics, also introduced to our students, at least in classical conversations, through the Lost Tools of Writing. The 5 common topics being definition, comparison, circumstance, relationship, and testimony. So we're analyzing, we're asking questions about what's in front of us now so we can understand it better. We're thinking, we're contemplating, we're analyzing. And then there's the illuminating, identifying the main idea or the main logos. What is the truth here that we want to discover or uncover? And I like the question, what is the most important and why? So that as the student is wrestling with this and analyzing and asking the questions, they're able to identify something they want to stick with them. And then embodying, practicing, expressing, writing about it, creating music, an art piece. And this is where I pull in the 5 canons of rhetoric, which are memory, what do we know? Invention, that's what the 5 common topics are, 5 common topics of invention. We've gathered information about it. Now, how are we going to talk about it? And how are we going to express it? How are we going to deliver it? And finally, ruling. This is an Andrew Kern word. I like the word deliberation, which is a restful, playful, it could be in silence, it could be with others. It's a place to just let the information get absorbed, play with it, figure out, hey, oh, and then hear about it somewhere else in another talk and not realize that people have been talking about it all along, but now that you know the term or you know the idea, now you're able to plug in with that. So this is what Andrew presented as process of mimetic learning and my attempt to pull in some of those really important questions on how to engage with it. Lastly, a very important practice is community. Engage in interpersonal relationships and community, because we were not created to be alone. Ideally, one grows and matures to be a complete human, and we need others to do so. So this took me a really long time to learn. And some of you here in the room know this story because you've walked with me and my family through some very difficult chapters in my personal saga. My family and I like to say we've lived a John Grisham novel for the last 15 years. It has been an adventure of major legal battles. So just a short summary, and I have permission to share this. My husband was a financial investment advisor, and an investment that, or a transaction that he was involved with went south, and the state of Oregon began to investigate, and it turned into you can either take a plea deal for 3 years, or you can go to prison for 91 years. Which are you going to take? Well, he chose I'm not going to take the plea deal. I'm going to face the potential of 91 years in prison away from my family. And that came with a lot of an investigation and a trial, business partners taking plea deals, but we eventually ended up in a trial where most of the charges, which were racketeering, selling unregistered securities, and aggravated theft, most of them were dropped, but after what I like to say, after the jury hearing 2 weeks of Mr. Gray should have said this or Mr. Gray should have done that, and some confusing jury form issues, my husband was incarcerated for 3 years. And I was pregnant with our seventh. And so I found myself very alone with a lot of kids. How are you alone with all those kids? But my community came around, my church, my CC community, and I learned the value and the importance of letting go of my pride to ask and accept help. And it took something very dramatic like that to whittle that out of me. So he was gone for 3 years. So I've done the single mom stunt as well. He was close by. We had frequent trips and visits. My oldest was 14 when he went away, so she was 17 when he came home, and the youngest was 3. And 3 months after he arrived home, the Oregon Appellate Court overturned the conviction. So that was good news. Wow, but he's been gone all this time. How do you redeem that time? Well, it was with relationships and community. But the state wasn't done. The appellate court had said it's overturned, but the state can try again. So we spent months and months and months trying to, can we not do that? And then COVID hit, and so then that whole second trial got postponed. And then his attorney died, and so it got postponed even more. We had to then find a new attorney, and that took some time. And then the second trial was actually held in October of 2022. Thankfully, this attorney was able to help secure a not guilty verdict for the remaining charges, which were aggravated theft. So that was very, very good. the saga is not over. We are now in the state of Oregon. There is a law now that compensates wrongfully incarcerated persons, and so we are now on the end of pursuing the state for that time. So we're happy to talk about this story. My husband is here today, so you can ask him about all his adventures. And people ask me, will I write a book someday? Probably. I'm not sure quite when that will happen, but maybe someday. But the point of all of sharing all that is the value and the importance of relationships and community. If it hadn't been for the community, I wouldn't have made it. Yes, I had the Lord, but he was working through the people in my life. So we need each other. So in conclusion, we've talked about impediments, the barriers that get in the way. We've talked about some common patterns that we observe in human nature. We've looked at some best practices, and I'm sure there are many more, but those are the ones that came to me. So my challenge at the beginning was I wanted you each to think and contemplate on these ideas that I'm presenting, to do some self-evaluation and to intentionally choose a place of repentance or a next step of growth. So I'm going to ask you to take a few moments and reflect on these questions. Here are some questions for deliberation now and as you go forward. What is your greatest impediment that prevents your growth, success, or impact as a mentor or student? What pattern mentioned caught your attention and why? And which practice do you want to adopt, and how will that address or overcome your impediment? And I put those up there so that you can refer to them. But I'd like you to take just a couple of minutes to reflect, to think, to pray. And it doesn't have to all be answered right now. This can be done throughout the day, in the evening, when it's quiet, over the course of the next few days, weeks, months. Maybe it'll take years to really come to terms with what the Lord's asking you to do. So I'll give you a few minutes, and then I'm going to close with a wrap-up to the Shackleton story. For me personally, I need to just embrace that the gaps are going to be there, and we need the gaps. With parenting adult children and younger children, having that age range, it's very different, flipping back and forth between the different modes. And I have adult children who are still figuring out their way, aren't we all? But they're in that young adulthood place and they're looking at their parents and friends around them going, I want that and I want it now, as opposed to have learning the value of getting there. And I need to be okay with them wrestling and not trying to solve all their problems immediately and just give them the honor of being able to wrestle through those. So for me, it's listening, it's asking questions, it's so much of this is for me. I'm just sharing it with you. So to wrap up Shackleton's adventure, scant if any attention has been paid to this voyage, let alone Shackleton's own spiritual assessment of his voyage. Part of the reason may be Shackleton's brevity. When he wrote, he got straight to the point, including the religious point. His religious point, contained in his memoir, South, The Endurance Expedition, it underscores the personal side of providence. Christians, then, have two reasons to consider Shackleton, both as a trophy of God's providence and as a man who gives poignant testimony to providence. Note well Shackleton's own spiritual assessment of his struggles. Quote, when I look back at those days, I have no doubt that providence guided us, not only across those snowfields, but across the storm-strewn sea that separated Elephant Island from our landing place on South Georgia. I know that during that long and racking march of 36 hours over the unnamed mountains and glaciers of South Georgia, it seemed to me that often that we were four, not three. I said nothing to my companions on the point, but afterwards, Worsley said to me, Boss, I had a curious feeling on the march that there was another person with us. Crean confessed to the same idea. One feels the dearth of human words, the roughness of mortal speech, and trying to describe things intangible. But a record of our journeys would be incomplete without a reference to the subject very near to our hearts. End quote. So the glory is all God's, and that glory shines more brightly in light of the fact that Shackleton never once in any of his voyages attained his primary objective. Vocationally, he was a failure, and each of us fails too. Yet the same holiness, wisdom, and power that accompanied Shackleton now conduct each of us on our own voyages. Through both success and failure, even repeated failure, the same Creator surrounds us with exactly what he surrounds those men. As followers of Christ, we can say that our expedition is led by the most authentic hero of all, indeed, the only hero. His many humiliations guarantee both our present rescue and our future arrival at our celestial home. For the Christian, Shackleton's story provides an opportunity to stop taking providence for granted. Let us, therefore, let our God's good providence abide kindly and effectually upon our hearts. May you journey well. Thank you.
That was Patterns, Practices, and Impediments of Mimetic Mentorship by Diane Gray. You've been listening to a recording provided by Gutenberg College. You can find more information about Gutenberg College on our website at www.gutenberg.edu. Any broadcast or retransmission of this recording without the express written permission of Gutenberg College and the conference speaker is prohibited. Thank you for listening.